to the Richard Nixon Experience.
He was under attack constantly. And the liberal media and the liberal elite were constantly after him. And when I say liberal elite, or I talk Ivy League, I'm not talking about some young man or woman that's going to Princeton or Yale or Harvard or something like that. I'm talking about attitude, an attitude of superiority. And Nixon hated that.
Chapin was just 21 years old when he went to work for Richard Nixon in 1962, 34 when he went to prison for him, convicted of lying to a grand jury about Watergate. In his new book, The President's Man, the memoirs of Nixon's trusted aide, Chapin details life inside the White House and the lessons he learned 50 years ago that are so relevant today. Our political director, Rick Klein, spoke with him.
As special assistant to the president, Dwight Chapin's job was to anticipate Richard Nixon's every move, but not necessarily follow his every command.
I worked for him over such a long period of time that it was almost second nature to me. I knew how he thought or how he would want a certain situation to unfold. And that became really my credential, if you will, because I was able to anticipate exactly where he wanted to go and what he wanted to do.
You said often that people around Nixon were saving Nixon from Nixon, Haldeman's words, right? What did that mean in practice?
What it means is that sometimes the president would ask that something be done, and it was important not necessarily to follow through.
The White House aide was at Nixon's side for key moments in history, including that historic first trip to China.
We have been here a week. This was the week that changed the world.
The China opening in 1972 needs to be remembered for what it was, which was the most dramatic diplomatic trip in the history of any president. And the consequences of it have been immense. And of course, we're in the middle of this now. When Nixon went, it was a geopolitical thing where he was dealing with Russia on one side and China on the other. It's kind of interesting to look at the Olympics that are about ready to end and the fact that Putin and the China leader are there together and the United States is kind of missing from action in terms of any official what role. And that's not what Nixon would have wanted.
Nixon's foreign policy accomplishments were eclipsed by the scandal that took down his presidency, along with much of his inner circle.
I was a political football. I ended up in the wrong place at the wrong time. The name of the game was not to get Dwight Chapin. The name of the game was to bring down Richard Nixon.
The first to go on trial in connection to the Watergate break-in, Chapin writes that Nixon could be unsentimental in his use of people, but harbors no regrets about his years of loyal service.
He was pardoned, and it's never bothered you that he was pardoned while you and others went to prison defending him?
It's never bothered me. And I would say that anyone that thinks about it, the fact that he had to resign and leave office put him through his own hell. That was his incarceration.
He sees parallels to today with a political scandal involving White House records, congressional and criminal probes, and aides caught in the middle.
There's so many people now, many of them as young as you were then, who are caught up in all of these investigations, and they're being subpoenaed by congressional committees. So many people in former President Trump's orbit are now caught up in this maelstrom that seems like it's a never-ending thing. What do you say to them?
Bottom line, honesty, tell the truth, let the chips fall where they may. You can always recover. I'm living proof that you can recover.
Today marks 50 years since the Watergate break-in, the political scandal that led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon. A new book uncovers more about that historic day. KTLA's Gail Anderson spoke with the author and has more from the Nixon Presidential Library and Museum in Yorba Linda.
According to a new book about the 50th anniversary of the Watergate break-in entitled Watergate, A New History, written by Garrett M. Graff, nearly 69 people pled guilty or were convicted at trial in connection with the scandal. Among them, Dwight Chapin, President Richard Nixon's appointments secretary and deputy assistant.
I got caught up in a grand jury hearing where they felt that I had committed false and misleading statements. And they used that as a battery ram, basically, to get into the White House. So it I am not faultless. I participated to what ended up being Woodward and Bernstein and the media being able to get into the White House and then the prosecutions that took place.
In his new book, The President's Man, the memoirs of Nixon's trusted aide, Mr. Chapin writes the early reports of the Watergate break-in did not consume the White House. He blames former White House counsel John Dean for testifying before Congress June 1973 that President Nixon knew about the Watergate scandal and that he suspected there was taped evidence. April 1974, Mr. Nixon released transcripts of 46 taped White House conversations.
Nixon had gotten back from China and from Russia. He was riding incredibly high. He was coming into a convention against George McGovern. All of the signals, everything looked so positive, on a positive track. And there had been this break-in. It was getting coverage. Woodward and Bernstein were starting to do their reporting, but there was no tie into the White House. When Watergate happened, John Dean remained silent. Nixon ended up, therefore, ending up in what we know as the cover-up.
Mr. Chapin writes the Watergate scandal, unfortunately, overshadowed many of President Nixon's greatest accomplishments.
I mean, we have a man that brought about the all-volunteer army. He brought about Title IX for women. He established the Environmental Protection Agency. He brought forth the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act. He brought in low-income subsistence for poverty section of our country. He took desegregation in the South from somewhere around 80, 85% and got it down to 10%. And most important of all, when he became president, there were 510,000 troops in Vietnam. And when he left office, it was down under 10,000. And of course, the war was virtually ended.
Mr. Chapin has this comment for Political Observer's comparisons between the U.S. Senate Watergate Committee hearings and the current U.S. House Select hearings on the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol.
I believe that if Richard Nixon were alive today, he would be saying to the members of Congress, both the House and the Senate, hey, folks, let's get out of the political sandbox. The polls show that the public knows what the serious issues of this country are, and they want them solved. And I mean, you can begin with inflation, you can go, you know, gas prices, you can go any number of different ways. But having hearings about January 6th and pointing fingers, you know, that is all political type.
June 17th. The 50th anniversary of the Watergate break-in, revisited by Dwight Chapin, the President's Man. In Yorba Linda, Gail Anderson, KTLA 5 News.
Welcome to Bridging the Political Gap. I'm Randall Wallace. This is a special program highlighting one of President Nixon's assistants. He was his appointment secretary. He was the first person drawn into the Watergate scandal or mess, and I think it's worth noting that He was charged with perjury in something unrelated to the Watergate break-in. And really, we have an oral history from Alexander Haig where Haig tells a story about Richard Benvenist threatening him by saying he's going to just keep him on the stand until he can find some technicality to get him on, just like he got Dwight Chapin. And I looked at that and said, you know, when you look at the other things that we're going to be showing you about Richard Benvenist, I shook my head. It is a It is a travesty of justice that somebody like Dwight Chapin was drawn into that.
Had made a mistake. I did not, in my opinion, lie to the grand jury. I know what the intent was in my heart. I know my whole attitude was to be truthful and forthright with the FBI and in my grand jury hearings. But the documents and my fellow citizens felt that I had committed making false and misleading statements, and I paid the price. The price was hard. Going to prison was incredibly difficult, but something that one can overcome. I think, if nothing else, my story proves that you can bounce back off of these things. But it was a difficult period for me, and I put it into the perspective this way. Eddie Carlson, who was the chairman of United Airlines, where I had been working before I had to leave to take care of this legal obligation, he said, "Dwight, you got to understand you're a political football." I viewed it always as a political event. I never viewed myself as a criminal or having done criminal activities. This was the Democratic Party, particularly the Kennedy wing of the party. It was the media, as I described in the clip that you showed at the start of the show. This was an effort to bring down Richard Nixon. Did he help make that happen? He sure did. I mean, there's no question about that. Foolish mistakes were made. But at the bottom line, the denominator on this is that it was a political event.
As we've done these shows, Dwight Chapin has shown up in his oral histories about the silent majority speech, about the trip to China, and that was our highest set of rated shows, by the way. And his insights and his oral histories are mesmerizing. I mean, they are just fascinating. And this book is right there with him. It is a great book, and I highly recommend it to people. It's called The President's Man, The Memoirs of Nixon's Trusted Aide by Dwight Chapin, and it has got some great recommendations. Here's one, quote, the book we've been waiting 50 years for, filled with new details on every page and beautifully written. It will force us to reassess Richard Nixon yet again. This is from Douglas Brinkley and Luke A. Nichter, the authors of the Nixon Tapes. And Luke Nichter is NixonTapes.org, the guy that runs that site, and who has also been an assistant to me as I put these shows together. And I would thank him tremendously, just advice and so forth over what has been. This is a huge undertaking, this documentary podcast we've done. But I want to do a special show kind of highlighting Dwight Chapin. He's been out promoting his book, and it has been a home run everywhere he's been. And one of them was an event that was held, I believe, at the Library of Congress. And it featured several people, along with Mr. Chapin, the executive editor of the Washington Post, Leonard Downey, and Lee Wright Rigour, if I mispronounced that name. She was an associate professor at Johns Hopkins University. And the columnist, Margaret Sullivan, and a gentleman that I've had some issues with, and I want to be upfront about that, and his name is Rick Perlstein. He's an author of a book called Nixon Land. But it was an extraordinary day, and we're going to have some clips from it, because I've told this about the 50th anniversary this year of Watergate was a grand slam home run, a renaissance, if you will, for President Richard Nixon. It started out on C-SPAN with a debate between Jill Winebanks and Jeff Shepard, in which he just absolutely ate her lunch. And I, you know, as you know, we think of the prosecutor's force as the sinister force of Watergate on our show. We've said that over and over again. Then this event, in which Dwight Chapin really talked about his time with the president, and we've got some clips of that, and we're going to show you, let you take a listen to them. Plus, another event that was with Mr. Chapin and Ken Kachigian, who worked for President Nixon, both on the campaign side and later on worked with Ronald Reagan. So it's an all-star cast in a very special edition look at Dwight Chapin and his book, The President's Man, The Memoirs of Nixon's Trusted Aide.
Go right down the row here. So to Dwight Chapin. So Dwight Chapin, 50 years and 4 months ago, you were at President Nixon's side when he made his historic trip to China. Yes?
Yes.
And you write about that in your memoir,
yes,
The President's Man. But a few years later, you were the first person to go on trial in the aftermath of Watergate, and ultimately you did serve a prison term.
Yes.
So in this past February, in an interview with The Guardian, which I think was associated with your book being published, you said, "There's no question I was heartbroken. There's no question I went through hell, but so did he," meaning President Nixon. So I want to ask you, now that you have 5 decades of perspective, do you have regrets about your own role or what you saw and countenanced and were a part of when you were in the White House?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for having me here and for all of you being here. And obviously, the bulk of the audience is on my side on this argument.
You can pretty much feel it.
I feel incredibly comfortable, so thank you. No, in my book, The President's Man, I make the point that serving President Nixon and all of the privileges and everything else that came my way, and it was an incredible experience and a wonderful experience. The only problem was that there was a price tag called Watergate. So when that happened and I went through it, it was traumatic for me, it was traumatic for my family, obviously for the country, but maybe most of all for President Nixon. He was a very proud man, he was a very good man, he had worked hard for the public his whole life. For decades he had done public service, and he had to resign. And I say in my book, I think that was probably his own hell and as bad for him as me having to go to prison. I would also like to make the point, because I think strategically, in terms, you have to understand the atmosphere in which all of this happened. I agree with you, sir. I think investigative reporting was key in this. I also look forward at the end of this meeting, Mr. Broder's son, because I too think he was one of the great reporters of all times, and I got to know him. But I want to make this point. Nixon was riding so high. There's something about it in Washington. I remember seeing the cover of Newsweek magazine, and it had Michael Deaver on the cover and a Jaguar parked out over here on the other side of the Capitol, with the Capitol in the background, and here was this thing on this great lobbyist. And I was working in Tokyo at the time, and I called Bryce Harlow, who was one of the great understanding persons of Washington. I said, "Bryce, what do you think of that cover of Deaver in the magazine?" He says, "Watch for the fall." And, you know, with Nixon, we went to China, he came back, we went to Russia, we came back, he goes to the convention, he comes up, he's approaching that election, he is at a popularity level not to be believed. And we have in this town, like it or not, an axis of Democrats, the media, it turned out to be the prosecutors, and to a degree the judicial system. That's what my friend Judge Jeff Shepard's writing about. So we weigh that against all of the investigative reporting and everything else. We think that this was a political event, and it was. It had criminal aspects to it, no question. But Richard Nixon, at the end of his life, said he considered Watergate his last campaign, and he lost. But his definition of the last campaign was because he viewed it as a political event.
Now, we've been covering that last campaign throughout our podcast, and what I thought we would be interesting to hear is Mr. Chapin's experiences of and descriptions of, you know, being around Richard Nixon, because more so than just about any other staff person, Dwight Chapin was with Richard Nixon right long before the presidential campaign. He came on early on when President Nixon was still figuring out what he was going to do and how he was going to do it when he was in the 1962 time frame. Dwight Chapin knew Richard Nixon as good as any employee that President Nixon had. So he has insights that very few people had.
Nixon was an introvert in an extrovert's business. He was incredibly bright. He was a hard worker. His work ethic was unbelievable. He was a patriot, and he believed deeply in America. He did everything in his power to conduct his presidency in a way that would help the American people and that would bring about peace in the world. So he was, in my estimation, an incredible president and a man of great distinction.
Ken, how would you answer that? And how would you assess both his strengths and his weaknesses as a politician and as a president?
Well, he was Danny was fascinating. Sitting with him for hours and hours here in San Clemente after his presidency, to hear him talk about, he didn't talk about normal people like you and I did. He talked about Winston Churchill and Nehru and Khrushchev and all the great leaders of the world, Dwight Eisenhower. And he dropped those names like you and I would talk about our neighbors. And so there was an enormous fascination in learning about American history and world history with him. So he had just enormous knowledge of and he was had a great grasp of history. And like Dwight said, he was an extremely hard worker. So that was his great strength that he brought to the world stage, all that background and history that helped him do enormous negotiations that he did with the strategic arms talks and anti-ballistic missile treaties that he did. And that was his strength. I'd say what weakness he had was probably, like Dwight said, he was an introvert and he preferred time alone a lot of it. He didn't like to get out. His main hobby was just working. So I don't know that I didn't see all those weaknesses in him that people talked about. I saw a lot of things in him that people didn't see. Like, you know, one thing I remember about him that people don't know about him was a soft side to him. When Hubert Humphrey was dying back in 1978, I was with him when he placed calls to Hubert Humphrey, and the two great warriors were talking with each other in a sense that this warmth passing between them, it was just extraordinary, Dan. You couldn't believe it.
Just as an aside, listening to Mr. Kajigian talk about the warmth between President Nixon and Hubert Humphrey, who was dying, I want to read something. And, you know, I started our podcast, our very first podcast, with a letter that was written by a man named Norman Sherman. I actually started my book, Always Vote Your Conscience, Don't Take It Personally, Don't Fight the Same Old Battles Again, over and over again, which I wrote in 2019 with this letter because it stood out so tremendously. And Norman Sherman was Hubert Humphrey's press secretary during his vice presidency, including during the 1968 campaign, and he was the editor of Hubert Humphrey's autobiography, and this appeared in the New York Times on February 15th, 2016, Section A, page 18. And I just want to read it here because, you know, a lot of people give Jimmy Carter credit for Richard Nixon's beginning of his comeback, because he walked into the room and spoke to President Nixon, who was kind of sitting by himself at Humphrey's funeral. But take my word on it, there's a whole other lot of story behind how Mr. Carter treated President Nixon. But the Hubert Humphrey, when he lost, Nixon had this, Dwight Chapin talked about in a story that was in my very first episode about Nixon. It was on CBS Morning News about it, how President Nixon reached out to him and after the election was over, and Humphrey was so upset. But here's a little bit more about that. It goes, to the editor, political debate doesn't have to be a food fight, nor does civility need to become a victim of ideological difference. Opponents can disagree without being disagreeable in campaigns and in office. In January 1969, President Richard M. Nixon called Hubert H. Humphrey, the defeated Democratic candidate for president, who was leaving Washington. They were certainly not friends. Nixon offered a plane to have to take the Humphreys home, saying they should leave with some dignity, not standing in line to check luggage. When the Humphreys got aboard, there was a bouquet with a card that said, "With best wishes, Pat and Dick." In 1978, less than a week before he died, Humphrey called Nixon, self-isolated in California. He said there would be a memorial service after his death in the Capitol Rotunda, with Presidents Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford and Lady Bird Johnson. He asked Nixon to be there. Nixon said he just couldn't face D.C., but Humphrey persuaded him to attend. On the plane taking Humphrey's body home, I asked Mrs. Humphrey why Nixon, of all people, was there. She said Hubert thought no president of the United States should live in exile. Civility, in both directions, overcame petty partisanship. Signed, Norman Sherman, who was then living in Tucson, Arizona. And I think that's a great story. And, you know, we have a call after the election's over between President Nixon and Hubert Humphrey that is also fascinating.
Mr. President, Hubert, how are you?
Well, fine, and I wanted to call up just to congratulate you on this historic victory.
Well, thank you very much.
You racked them up.
You've been a very statesmanlike man. Yes, I always, when just speaking as friends, people ask me very privately to compare this with 68, and I said, well, the difference is that when Senator Humphrey and I were campaigning and we had this terrible issue of Vietnam, we both put the country first. And I said, this time, I said, we had a problem where one fellow said any goddamn thing that came in his head.
Yeah.
Your private information, and you should know, for 3 days, I had the whole thing in my pocket.
Yes.
And you probably guessed. As you probably guessed.
Yes. I had a talk with Henry a couple of days ago.
Right.
They asked me whether or not we could have got a settlement like this in 69. I said no.
Yeah. Well, you made a great statement. I asked Henry to call you, but I think you should know that.
Thank you.
Within 10 days, you will see it's all fallen into place, and we knew it a week ago, but we couldn't say it. I mean,
well, I understood that.
But I felt you had to fight for your man. I understood why, but I know that you didn't approve of some of the tactics.
Well, I'll have a talk with you sometime. I knew it, you know, I did what I had to do.
Of course you did.
If not, Mr. President, this whole defeat would have been blamed on me and some
That's
of
right.
my associates.
That's right. That's right.
I know that.
That's right. Well, we'll get together and we'll work for the good of the country. That's the important thing.
Surely will. And I didn't want to let this night go by without.
Well, it's so good of you to call. And how are you feeling?
I'm feeling fine. By the way, my son was elected to the state senate out here.
Isn't that great? Well, I hope we didn't run a man against him to give him any trouble.
Well, as a matter of fact, the man that ran against him is a very fine man. I was afraid the boy wasn't going to win.
Right.
But
isn't that great?
It's a good campaign, and you can imagine I feel pretty good tonight.
We have some good things going on here, and are you in Minnesota now?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. How's that coming out? I don't know. I haven't seen that. I see it's very close.
Yes. Of course, what you've got here now, Mr. President, is the city votes are in.
Do you think, how do you project it?
I think you'd win out here, but not by as large as you would in other states.
Yeah. But we
never do. Minnesota's always closer.
We're fairly well organized out here.
But I know. Yeah, that's right, particularly with you coming out, you see. You heard us, you see.
Well, I did.
But we didn't need you this time like 60, so I won't hold it against you.
I did my duty.
Okay. But you think we'll win it? You think we'll win it at the moment, seriously?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I think that that you'll most likely come out of here with between 50 and 100.
Okay. I'll hold you to that. Anything less than 50, I'm going to make you pay.
Make me pay, are you? All right. Well, you and Pat both look good on that TV tonight.
Oh, well. And those things are so hard to handle with us. Yeah. And roaring crowds, but
I've never told you how much I appreciated that handwritten letter, but I just want you to know that my wife and I cherish it.
Listen,
it meant a great deal to me.
I've been through this, and I meant it from the heart.
I know that.
Anyway, we'll do some good things for this country in the next year.
Righto, and
4 years, Hubert.
There he is. I told Henry you can depend on us.
I know it.
We're going to be there.
And just remember, whenever you think you're going to, you're checking yourself out, read about Churchill. I was reading Peter de Messingle's new. It isn't new. It's a great biographer, California, the other day. You know, Hubert, when he was 68, he became prime minister, and Israeli was 68, so what the hell? You're still in your 60s.
Yeah, I know, but we Minnesotans got a bad reputation for running too often.
Okay.
You know about it.
Well, good luck, and thank you for being such a statesman.
All right, friend. Goodbye.
You can just feel the obvious warmth between the two men, despite the fact that they had run against one another, sort of like Bush and Clinton. Or Ford and Carter, but you could really sense that Hubert Humphrey and Richard Nixon had a warmth between them. And I've always said that of all the Democratic nominees, I'm not one for feeling sorry for him, but I always felt bad for Hubert Humphrey because he just seemed like a very nice man. And I think you picked that up in this phone call, that President Nixon and Vice President and then Senator Humphrey were friendly with one another, had a great deal of respect and warmth for one another, and that's something that President Nixon often doesn't get the credit he deserves for, or the recognition for. They've oversold him as a villain, I think, some of these folks. So anyway, Dwight Chapin was there, as he talks about in his book, and he at the right there for a long period of time with President Nixon, and that included 1972. And I think people don't realize when they hear about Watergate in 72 that by the time President Nixon came back, and we do a show on his arrival back from the Soviet Union when the helicopter comes in there, it is the peak of his political career. And I think for that brief period of time in 72, right before the 49-state landslide, is the one period of time that President Richard Nixon really got to enjoy what I think history is going to remember him for being, and that is one of the four, up to at least to this point, one of the four greatest presidents in American history. He had risen above politics and to that stature that is very rare of a true statesman on the world stage.
Give me a sense of kind of where you all were at that point in early June of 1972, given what you had done in the first number of months. Was there a sense of celebration, but also a certain kind of, you know, concern or even paranoia about the upcoming election?
I don't think so. I don't remember any paranoia about the upcoming election. We were on a high. I mean, the president had that incredible journey to the opening of China, and then, as you say, the signing of the SALT agreements in Moscow. And it was I personally thought I had seen kind of a transition from being president to his being world statesman. I mean, these journeys were not only focused on by America and by the American media, but, you know, around the world, he was taking on a certain aura that was a real high. And when he went into the Congress that night that we got back from the Moscow trip and the helicopter landed at the Capitol, I mean, it was a thunderous ovation in there. And as you say, it's almost, it is kind of a line of demarcation in the from the fact that Watergate happened just a few weeks later. But I would say that it did not really impact us until well past the convention, until we got into the October period. I mean, he rode that high all the way to Miami for the Republican convention in August. And then, of course, as you know, he had this incredible landslide, 18 million votes, carried every state except Massachusetts and the District of Columbia. So, I mean, the power of the apex that he had risen to stayed with him right on through the election. And then it was the post-election when it really started getting messy.
This is Randall Wallace, your host for Bridging the Political Gap. I want to thank you first for tuning in to our podcast and invite you to come to our website, randallwallace.com. There you can get a copy of our book, Always Vote Your Conscience, Don't Take It Personally, and Don't Fight the Same Old Battles Over and Over Again, with a lot of policy suggestions and things that I think everyone could embrace, an argument for why we need to be working together instead of fighting with each other. Also, you can take a look at the first 11 episodes of this podcast, which was a podcast documentary that looked at the World War II generation of bipartisan leadership that built the American century and the lessons we can learn from them to apply to today's situations. Again, thanks for tuning in to our podcast. And if you've enjoyed our show, please leave us a review at wherever you get your podcast. And now, let's get back to the show.
Have to remember that what you haven't mentioned was Vietnam was looming over us the entire time. And what Dwight didn't mention is that even after this triumphal return from China in June and all the summits and everything else, we still had the Vietnam War and trying to get these peace talks going. And that was a constant effort from the beginning of the Nixon presidency until the peace talks ended.
One of the things that's often forgotten when people talk about Watergate, they actually act like it was something going on off by itself. But this point that Ken Kajigian makes is pretty valid, and that is that this war was consuming all of their time, and it hung over the campaign and the administration. And even after he comes back from Moscow, and they're going into the final run for the presidency to re-election in 72, you still have this war lingering and dragging on. And Nixon is totally preoccupied in 1972. He goes to China. He goes to the Soviet Union. He's negotiating, trying to get out of the Vietnam War. He's got the campaign to run. And Watergate is really a small story. There's no real connection to the White House. And that's where the mistake is made by the president. And that's a point that President Nixon has made over and over again in retirement, and advice that he gave to leaders. And that is, great leaders take care of the big things, but they don't take care of the small things very well. And herein lies the mistake that he made. He didn't take care of a small thing when he should have, right when it started.
He said after the presidency that he needed to get out front right away, and that he didn't do that. And so he misled himself at the outset, and he didn't get out in front right away, and that was his real mistake. And so he paid the price for it.
I think it is important that as we consider this historical segment of the program that we put it in perspective, that 1972, as you know, was a very big year. A lot of things were going on. Winston Churchill once wrote strong leaders usually do the big things well, but they foul up on small things, and then the small things become big. I should have read that before Watergate happened. In 1972, we went to China, we went to Russia, we ended the Vietnam War effectively by the end of that year. Those were the big things. And then here was a small thing, and we fouled it up beyond belief. It was a great mistake. It was wrong, as I pointed out over and over again. But under the circumstances, now people, as they judge that period, have to see what we accomplished and what we did wrong. And for the future, I would advise all those that follow me and the position of president, do the big things as well as you can. But when a small thing is there, deal with it. Deal with it fast. Get it out of the way, because if you don't, it's going to become big, and then it may destroy you.
But afterwards, he brought back, he restored his life after the presidency. I give him credit for that. And, you know, he gave back to the country and to the world. He wrote 8 best-selling books after he left the presidency. He advised other presidents. He advised President Reagan. He advised him in his 2 presidential campaigns. He advised President Clinton. And, I think the world would be better off if he was around today advising President Biden, very frankly.
Isn't that the truth? I wish President Nixon was here to advise President Biden. We're going to move on to some stories now that Dwight Chapin had told about, you know, various things during this event celebrating the 50th anniversary of Watergate. This is about Mark Felt, and I am not a Mark Felt fan, for all the reasons that Dwight Chapin mentions. But the editor of the Washington Post, Leonard Downey Jr., who is in this event, will also tell the story about how Mark Felt's name came up his deep throat later, and Bob Woodward's relationship with him.
I know, Dwight Chapin, that you think that Mark Felt was very wrong in what he did. You've said that in interviews, and I think written it. Why don't you tell us briefly what your objection is to the use of a source like that to get to the truth?
Oh, yes. let's not use... let's look at it this way. I was raised in Kansas and then California to respect the FBI. I was respectful of the FBI. I never lied to the FBI. I told them the absolute truth from day one. Okay? My issue was a grand jury issue, which is different than the FBI. But when someone takes an oath to uphold the laws of the Constitution of the United States, and they are the second-ranking person in the FBI, as Mark Felt was, I think if it's true, and I doubt seriously that it's only one person that's deep throat. I think Al Haig is in there too.
Okay.
In fact, I become more convinced every day that Al Haig was in there. But Mark Felt, because of his own selfishness, you've got to understand, this is a political war. He wanted to head the FBI. When Hoover died, Felt was furious he did not get that job and that it went to Pat Gray. So he decides that he's going to leak this information to Bob Woodward and that he's going to embarrass Nixon, and Nixon's going to get pissed off and he's going to fire Pat Gray and he's going to take Mark Felt and make him the head of the FBI. I'm shorthanding it, but that's kind of the strategy. And I look at Mark Felt, and I can have nothing but contempt for that as an American citizen. Forget whether I'm a Republican, Nixon person, whatever. To me, that's just outrageous.
Okay, how do you really feel, though? I would like, Len, if you would talk about the role of Mark Felt and the role of sources like that. And then just fair warning, because I actually do want to take audience questions, I'm going to kind of do a lightning round in which I ask everyone what, in your particular area of interest, what is the most lasting legacy of Watergate? So, but
All right. Well, Bob Woodward met Mark Felt in the White House when Bob was in the Navy. They were both in an ante room waiting for a long time for their appointments, and they got to know each other well, and they liked each other. Bob contacted Mark Felt on a couple other occasions for help with stories, which he gave him. But Felt was very reluctant to talk to him about Watergate. And that famous underground garage scene in the movie is pretty accurate about that. It does show how reluctant he was. And back at the newspaper, we were concerned about making sure that we knew who all their sources were, except for that particular one. We wanted to know what their sources had told them and under what circumstances. So we had them, every time they conducted an interview with a source that was not named in the newspaper, a confidential source, to whom they gave confidentiality for life, unless the source released them from that confidentiality. They had to write out all their notes, and they had to put the name of the source at the top of it. Alexander Haig was one of those names, by the way. He's not Deep Throat. It went all the way up to the top of the White House, and many other parts of the government and politics and so on. But not Mark Felt, because Bob had promised him he wouldn't tell anybody who he was. Ben agreed with that. Ben didn't know who he was. I didn't know who he was. Barry Sussman didn't know who he was. Katharine Graham didn't know who he was. As a result of that, we did not ever publish anything directly from Mark Felt, except in one small instance where it was adding on to something else, and we all regretted it afterwards.
It was guidance.
Mm-hmm. He would tell Bob when he was on the right track. He would tell him he was on the wrong track. He sometimes told Bob things, or intimated things to Bob that never turned out to actually be true, which is why we didn't publish anything that he said. We used him for guidance. So I'll give a quick anecdote. I was always wondering who Deep Throat really was. We went on for decades, and people were speculating about it. People wrote books about it. People wrote magazine articles about it. A couple people guessed right, but we never told them that they guessed right. Because I didn't know yet. So I decided I'm going to have to guess, because I knew who all those other people were. Therefore, they weren't Deep Throat. It had to be somebody else. So my first guess was a former deputy attorney general fired in the Saturday Night Massacre. And when he died, Bob said, no, it's not him. L. Patrick Gray was my second guess. And he was living so long that Bob finally came to me and said, he's still alive, but it's not him. He just wanted to put me out of my misery. So then I thought really hard, and I realized Mark Felt, now number two in the FBI, number three in the FBI, when actually I dealt with him a couple times on stories, as first as a reporter and then as an editor. So I wrote his name down on a piece of paper, and the reason why I thought it might be him, I gave it to Bob, and I said, when Deep Throat dies, I want to know if this is the name, this is the right name. So as you may recall, Mark Felt's family wanted him to be outed, wanted him to be known as Deep Throat before he died. Bob went to see him, took him out to lunch. Felt barely knew who Bob was. He figured the dementia was so far gone that he really couldn't consent, so he didn't do it. So the family went to Vanity Fair, published it in Vanity Fair.
Right.
Bob Woodward, Don Graham sitting in the front row here, I was conducting an editor's retreat and going on some long spiel like the one I'm doing right now. They all had to listen to me because I was the editor. And everybody's phone goes off, and we all turn it off, except for Don, because he's a Boy Scout. He figures somebody's calling him in the middle of this meeting. It must be important. He goes outside. There's a big picture window. I can see him out there, and he goes, and I did. And it was Bob Woodward on the phone. And he told me about the Vanity Fair piece, and he wanted to talk me out of the post identifying him because he still didn't have his permission. Mm. So I raced back to Washington, breaking many speed limits but not getting arrested. And I told Bob, it's over. And so we went ahead and did everything. Bob had also written a book about his relationship with him, and that's another reason why I think he was reluctant, because he wanted his book to be the way in which it was revealed.
Huh. He never did that again, though, huh?
No.
Right. This next segment is one where I really do agree with him, Mr. Chapin, in that what happened in Watergate could not happen again today. But you do not have the same media landscape, and I think it's a good thing. There's a lot, you know, we did a podcast titled Have We Created Frankenstein's Monster? But with all of its drawbacks of what's happened with the division we have in the country, I still think it's very important that this alliance between the liberal media and the Democratic Party have some way for a Republican to answer it, because what happened to Richard Nixon should never have happened, and thankfully, it could not happen today. And it shows, because you see these people like Dan Rather or Elizabeth Drew, Carl Bernstein, Bob Woodward. If you follow them on Twitter, you see how they really feel. And you could see the frustration that they had that people weren't buying their act anymore the way when President Trump was there. But it was, I thought, a good thing that President Trump had an outlet to defend himself, be it Twitter, be it Fox News, Newsmax, etc.
I know you want to respond to every single thing that's been said.
No.
But I actually want to ask you to answer the question, what is the most significant legacy of Watergate in your view?
Yes, I think it zeroes right in on what Rick was talking about. I think one of the most consequential things that's happened, and it flies in the face of probably what a lot of people in this room think, and that is it couldn't happen now. And the reason it couldn't happen now is the age of NBC, CBS, ABC, the age of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times, the age of that media era that we were in is gone. It has been fragmented. We have cable systems, we have the internet, we have conservative voices everywhere. If Richard Nixon was going through what he went through today, he would have never resigned. He would have never been impeached, and the country would have been locked probably in this 50-50 situation that we have, which raises a whole other set of questions that we need to figure out how to get around, how to talk to one another, how to cooperate, and how to move this country ahead. But my view is that what we witnessed and what I went through and what the president went through couldn't happen again.
I agree. I agree with you. In fact, I think, and it ties in with the media situation as well.
Right.
And Len.
I'll be a little bit more narrow and talk about journalism. Before Watergate, before the Pentagon Papers, Watergate, in Vietnam, there was very little investigative reporting in American media for decades. I was one of the few investigative journalists in the 1960s at the Washington Post, and there were some others scattered around the country. We mostly focused on local things. There was no investigative reporting about the national government or national politics or anything like that, not to mention no investigative reporting about anything outside government either, corporations, charities, schools, religion, et cetera. And as a result of Watergate, as a result of the fame of Bob and Carl and the movie and all of that, the investigative reporting took off throughout the American media and remains today the most important thing the American media is doing. Is investigative reporting, what I call accountability journalism, mm-hmm. holding every aspect of American life accountable to the rest of us, mm-hmm. Sports, entertainment, what have you. And good examples of that, of course, are the Me Too movement, which grew directly out of investigative reporting. The investigations of the Catholic Church's treatment of children grew directly out of investigative reporting. Just a few days ago, the Southern Baptist Convention had to deal with sexual harassment in that particular religion as a result of investigative reporting. And so that to me is the most important legacy of Watergate.
Very good. Thank you.
This next exchange is the very first question that was asked at this symposium at the Library of Congress. And I included it because L. Patrick Gray was mentioned earlier in this show concerning Mark Felt. And we did a show that in our overall podcast on L. Patrick Gray and Mark Felt. And it's titled The Innocent Man of Watergate. And though I think Mr. Gray had a lot of bitterness toward President Nixon that I don't think was justified, perhaps, it's certainly understandable. And I think of just anybody involved in this, without any question, L. Patrick Gray is the guy who is the most innocent and the most maligned. And a lot of what's been said and done to his reputation was extraordinarily unfair. And this is his grandson that's going to ask this question. And if he ever listens to the show, I hope that he knows that that is the show that we've got goes through it and uses a lot from his book. And while, like I say, I don't think that it's justifiable to be as angry with President Nixon as he is, Mr. Gray was, I should say, it's understandable. And as we say, he is, beyond a shadow of doubt, the innocent man of Watergate.
Someone to break the ice and ask the first question. So, yes, there's a hand up over there. And please, everyone, think of what you might like to ask.
Hi, just for full disclosure, my name is Will Gray, and L. Patrick Gray was my grandfather, so I'm coming at this with a little bit of bias right away. I think Mr. Chapin, my family, and I can probably understand a little bit about what you talk about with the hell that you went through. I did want to ask Mr. Downey, in the answer to your first question, when you talked about who was responsible for bringing down Nixon and who was responsible for leading to the resignation of Mr. Nixon, you did not reference the FBI at all. I was wondering if you could speak to that, given that Mr. Felt was very much a part of that investigation at the FBI and was guiding your own investigation. Thank you.
Sure. Well, the FBI, of course, was supposed to be investigating Watergate. Once it became clear that it wasn't just a local burglary, that it had other implications, that it reached up into the White House, the FBI had to be investigating. And the local prosecutors, the local U.S. attorneys were investigating the burglars and a couple of the people that worked with the burglars out of the White House. But that's what they were supposed to be doing. I think that Mark felt was frustrated that it appeared that somebody, either in the FBI or in the prosecutor's office or somehow in the White House office, was putting a lid on it, that the investigation was only going to go up this high. And higher up in the White House, they weren't really interested in going. And I think that was out of that, besides the fact that I agree with Dwight Chapin, he was also interested in his own ambition and his own bitterness about not running the FBI, he also felt that it was necessary to get somebody to be looking at what was really going on.
Okay.
Can I add something to
that? Of course.
One thing I found that's in my book, The President's Man, is we found an FBI report that was done after Watergate. It was in July of 1974, and they really come down hard. They call John Dean the master manipulator of Watergate. They use that term, and they talk about how Dean influenced the FBI and these reports and so forth within the White House structure, which was just outrageous.
That's why he came clean and went to jail.
Mm. Right.
John Dean came
clean. Became very famous and wealthy.
Yes. John Dean coming clean is a little absurd.
All right.
I'm sure you noticed the belligerent tone of Rick Perlstein. That's not the only time during this event that it happened.
On the Pentagon Papers, Nixon and Kissinger, what they were doing, really, it had nothing to do with the Nixon administration in terms of the Vietnam War. That was over papers about Johnson and Kennedy.
Correct.
On that. And then the other thing is, I had dinner last night with a very interesting man that knows all of this stuff. And he told me that between 1932 and 1972, there were anywhere from 125 to 300 black bag operations a year. And those statistics, he tells me, are in the church report, that this black bag operation. So the only reason I mention it, and it surely isn't a defense, but when you look at Nixon living through his Senate years, going through those vice president years and so forth, and what he knew about how things operated and about the CIA and so forth. I mean, he and Richard Helms were together on many things, including Caracas, which I had not known until there's a new book out called Dancing with Scorpions about the CIA, Dick Helms, and Richard Nixon. And that's a very insightful book because it shows the linkages of what was going on with the CIA and the executive branch of our government. So Nixon reaps all of this anger and hatred and all of these wrongdoings and everything. But there's a lot more to the story. And I, I would say another legacy of everything that we're witnessing, and especially of this building, the Library of Congress. There are two books that I'm aware of that are being done on the relationship of Watergate and the CIA. We're uncovering stuff. We're still uncovering stuff. It's unbelievable. We're still uncovering stuff. So there's going to be additional volumes put into this library someday that are going to help explain this even more.
Rick, you look like you want to say something.
Well, there's a bit of confusion there. There are procedures within the law for what are called black bag jobs, right? Which is kind of basically entering, you know, and finding information, right? Search warrants, for example.
I think the point of the entire church hearings was that the FBI was not following search warrants and so forth, the procedures that were within the law, which Mr. Perlstein doesn't mention in this little take. Plus, when he starts dumping off on Nixon and the Houston plan, which, you know, I'm not advocating for anything illegal here, but Nixon was dealing with top secret secrets getting out into the press, including our fallback positions in Vietnam and, of course, the Pentagon Papers, and no telling what else Daniel Ellsberg could have stolen because he had top secret clearance. You had the Radford Moore affair where the Joint Chiefs of Staff were spying on President Nixon, and he needed to put a stop to these leaks, and he wasn't able to get the FBI to act. Plus, you had subversive activity going on in the anti-war movement. There's a lot of reasons why President Nixon took steps that under normal circumstances would not have been the case.
And the point about Nixon's operation of SAME was that in a famous memo written by one of his staffers, Tom Charles Houston, in 1970, he said, the FBI is not doing this stuff, we got to do it ourselves, and it's clearly, quote unquote, illegal, right? And then Nixon says, that's a great idea. Then he says, well, you know what, I had second thoughts. And then what happens in the basement of the White House by the plumbers is largely the same thing.
All right, I want to move to another.
I just want to make
I
one more
move
point.
To another question.
For example, I mean, Dwight in his book says things that there are memos that directly contradict what he says in his book.
Okay, I'm going to go to an audience question, sir.
Anyway, folks, I think you have seen the belligerent attitude that Mr. Rick Perlstein. He is the writer of a book called Nixon Land. And as I had mentioned briefly when I was introducing this show, I did have a situation online with Mr. Perlstein. It was rather childish. It was on Twitter. It was a couple weeks before this event. And, you know, after he showed up on this Library of Congress event with Mr. Dwight Chapin and I did some research to figure out who he was. And what I discovered was that he's not a college professor. He's not a historian. He's a writer of books. But he basically, he's sort of a internet aggregator who just, you know, gets his stuff off the internet. Well, guess what? I am too. But at least I'm not online, you know, accusing people who have a different opinion of being conspiracy theorists or calling them names or insulting a man like Dwight Chapin who actually lived through the experience. Now, with that, I want to end with an insight that Dwight Chapin had that I think is pretty important because it's something that I have found. I've said this to people all of my life. I've looked into and researched Richard Nixon, and on everything other than Watergate, he usually came out right, whether he ran an ugly campaign against Helen Cahagan Douglas, when in fact Mrs. Douglas started the mudslinging in that campaign, the fund scandal, which turns out that Adlai Stevenson had a fund just like it, the IRS accusations when Nixon's taxes were audited throughout the 1960s. You know, we could just go on and on and on of looking into things that Richard Nixon was accused of that it turns out that there's no merit to it. And Watergate was that exception to the rule, and I always chalked it up before we got into really researching with the new evidence that Jeff Shepard has discovered Nixon's men got him in a mess, and he screwed it up trying to get out of it, and, you know, it is what it is. But I think it's interesting to see now 50 years down the road that so much material has come out that is exculpatory, and there may be more. And Dwight Chapin makes this point. And that's how I want to end this show. Other than to just say, this is an excellent book, The President's Man by Dwight Chapin. I highly recommend you getting it. And any chance you got the opportunity to listen to anything that Dwight Chapin, where he's speaking or whatever, I advise you go there, because whether it's China, the silent majority speech, Watergate, the Nixon administration, I have never heard him speak that I wasn't just totally enthralled with the insights that you come away from. And with that, we'll let Mr. Chapin discuss the Nixon tapes.
I was stunned. I had no idea, Dan, that the taping mechanism was in place. The people that knew that, it was a very small group of people. I immediately thought, this is going to be interesting. I did not know what would come of it. I will say this, and I cover this in my book, the tapes are going to end up perhaps being a blessing as time goes on, because the tapes, as we get into more and more of them, are starting to provide us material that is exculpatory for President Nixon. I mean, what happened with the prosecutors, and when these tapes were put out, that they did these slices of the tapes, all of which shows the abuse of power and so forth, but they don't show the complete story of what was going on within the presidency and how some of the comments fit into context. So I think there's a lot of road to travel here. We're 50 years into it, but we're a long way from getting to all of the bottom level of what this thing was all about.
I just wanted to be sure to understand, as far as the president is concerned,